Go. And we're on.
We're on.
How are you, John?
Hi, Ross. Good to see you. Or hear you.
Good to hear you. Happy Monday. It's a really wonderfully humid day here in Washington, D.C.
Yes.
And we're going to start off, I guess we should just dive right in with a subject close to your own heart, which is the case of Scott Thomas Beauchamp.
Yes.
Or Beauchamp. Or Beauchamp, or however you pronounce the last name that he didn't use when he was writing for the New Republic. And for those of our readers who, or viewers, excuse me, those of our viewers who haven't been closely following the, you know, big blog topic of the last 2 weeks.
In the News Republic, it's been in the Washington Post, New York Times, elsewhere.
Yeah, no, it's true. It's been everywhere. Actually, well, you know what? Since I have an actual New Republic senior editor here, maybe I should let you explain the Scott Thomas Beauchamp quasi/non-scandal.
Sure. Well, he's a private in the U.S. Army. He's been serving in Iraq, and he's written three dispatches. Not really dispatches, more like, most of them more like essays. The last one was a diarist recounting some of his experiences and reactions to being at war. The first two were not terribly controversial. The first one was about a young Iraqi boy who was pro-American and befriended the troops a bit, and then they happened to come upon him some weeks later, and his tongue had been cut out by insurgents for talking to the Americans. So you can see, you know, that wouldn't be controversial with the right. His last one was controversial. It recounted some pretty disturbing activities that he and some of his fellow soldiers had engaged in. Some of them mocked a disfigured woman, maybe a contractor of some sort, in the mess hall. He talked about how some of his fellow soldiers like to, you know, run over dogs in their Bradleys, and how some of them were digging and found some bones and kind of were playing around with them and not treating them very respectfully. This created a huge firestorm on the right. The Weekly Standard blogger named Michael Goldfarb seized upon this, and a lot of other right-wing bloggers who I wasn't familiar with previously. They sort of were suggesting that he wasn't a real soldier and that all the tales were made up. You know, so they started posting all these things. Some of it, most of it was not credible. Some of it seemed credible. So we, you know, we really decided we want to be extra sure. We sort of went beyond the initial fact check and sort of had threw everybody at the problem and talked to experts and see and try to track down other soldiers in the unit. And we got multiple corroborations for every incident. And, you know, experts told us that it was plausible that all these things could have happened, that Bradleys could be maneuvered in this way and whatnot, that, you know, a woman with facial injuries of this sort could still be in theater and that kind of thing. He got one important detail wrong, which is that the incident with a woman took place in a base in Kuwait, not in Iraq, and that was significant, but the rest of it held up pretty well. I think you've got right-wing bloggers still trying to claim victory. They've basically invested so much into persuading themselves and others that this is all a lie, that I think they've got to come away with something. So they're still at it a little bit, but I think they recognize when they've been whipped.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, okay. Well, so that's, you know, that's what your corporate masters would have us believe. But,
that's right.
But come on, John, you know, what's the real... In reality, Scott Thomas Beauchamp is a sock puppet for Frank Foer, right? I mean, that's what's actually going
on
here.
It's one of Frank's
brothers. Either that or he's an android that you've built in your fiendish subterranean dungeon where, you know, John Judas used to operate on Spencer Ackerman before he escaped and, you know, told the world, right? I mean, that's what's actually happening here, right? I mean, are you sweating? See, unfortunately, I can't see you as
something
I'm
like
interrogating
that.
You here, so I don't know if I'm getting through, but...
Beads of sweat are running down my forehead right now.
Good. Well, anyway, okay, so since I've got you on the ropes, I guess... Yeah, I mean, my impression of the whole thing was that, you know, I read the diarist, and I thought that the last one, it struck me as the sort of thing where... I suspected exaggeration, and so when Mike Goldfarb, who I know, first said, you know, hey, this is kind of fishy, we'd like to know more about this Scott Thomas character, I was totally on board for knowing more about this Scott Thomas character.
Yeah.
And I think that, you know, overall, I actually still I mean, you know better than that. Basically, I read the sort of from the editor's piece, and you know, it said, well, you know, we have multiple corroborations for each of these stories. I'm still sort of like rereading the piece. I still get the whiff of exaggeration about the anecdotes involved. You know, just sort of the way the Bradley fighting vehicle running over the dog is described, the way the incident in the mess hall where they're mocking the disfigured woman is described.
Yeah.
It overall still has the air of somebody telling a story, you know, to their friends at a bar months later, which isn't always the, you know, the worst thing in the world, but when you're dealing with a subject like the Iraq War, you know, that's obviously fraught in many ways.
Right.
I mean, my sort of sense, and I'm bracketing for the moment the Right Wing Blog's reaction, is that, you know, I'm a little bit skeptical about TNR's decision to run the pieces, not because it's a bad thing to have sort of obviously in theater accounts on the ground from soldiers, but partially just because, and I think this is part of what created the firestorm around it, it's not as if, you know, TNR has had a lot of, you know, the troops speak out kind of dispatches over the course of the war. And so there is a sense in which, you know, it felt to some people like the magazine was singling out this guy as like, okay, this, you know, this is the, you know, what's really going on with the soldiers. And in a situation like that, it did seem like, well, you know, you want to be careful. You don't want to have the whiff of exaggeration about it. All of that said, clearly the reaction on the sort of, you know, Michelle Malkin / Ace of Spades front was ludicrous, and I think that everything that liberal bloggers have said about that, that it sort of shows, you know, the fact that conservatives are dealing with the fact that, you know, a war that they supported has gone very, very badly, and they're sort of pining for the halcyon days when they could, you know, take a scalp and bring down Dan Rather and so on. And
right.
And a lot of the stuff that's been written, it's like, you know, Frank Foer and his minions are sitting around in an office cooking up ways to sabotage the U.S. effort in Iraq. And, you know, as anyone who's followed the debate over the war and the role that the New Republic has played over the last 4 years knows,
right,
that's, you know, fairly fairly ludicrous. But I wanted to sort of lift up maybe a little bit to a discussion of this issue of fact-checking, because I'm just sort of curious, not having... I mean, I work at The Atlantic, and oddly, I've only worked at The Atlantic. I was an intern for National Review in the summer and sort of got a brief glimpse of their fact-checking process. But, you know, my experience with the fact-checking process overall has been The Atlantic experience, which is essentially the New Yorker experience, but mm-hmm. revised in various ways, which is to say, I mean, the Atlantic's fact-checkers are amazing, like flat out, you know, these people, they essentially re-report every story from the ground up.
Right.
And do a great job. And even so, errors still slip through and so on. And overall, I'm a little bit skeptical about the role of fact-checkers at magazines like TNR and National Review and the Weekly Standard that are operating on a, you know, sort of more fly-by-the-seat-of-their-pants kind of schedule. But
right.
I guess I'm curious, like, what kind of fact-checking does a piece like The Beauchamp Diarist go through initially before this sort of fact-checking?
I want to go back and ask you a question. When you say your fact-checkers re-report everything, they mean, like, if you do interviews with sources, they go back and call up your sources and ask them if the quotes you have are correct?
Yes, but they also... Yes. But it's not just the quotes. I mean, it's not just double-checking quotes. It's double-checking. For instance, if I did an interview with someone and that interview, you know, went into the formation of a paragraph of analysis about, you know, U.S. energy policy, they would call up the source and say, is this an accurate reflection of your views on U.S. energy policy?
Mm-hmm.
But it also goes, essentially every fact has to, it's, you know, if I have an assertion that's based on a Brookings, you know, study from 1997, I have to deliver the Brookings study from 1997 to
right.
the fact checkers. And
it goes up
to the level of, you know, if I make a broad assertion like, you know, Republicans have a tough time winning the votes of minorities. Like, I need to provide a source for that.
I'm not a fact checker. I've never been a fact checker. I get fact checked, which means You know, any verifiable fact I have to show evidence for. You know, you're right. If I say a Brookings study said this, I have to show them the Brookings study. If I say, if I have a quote from someone, they're going to just check my notes to see if that's in the notebook, which isn't a way of checking to make sure I didn't make up the quote, but just to keep me from making mistakes. So they'll make me show the point of the notebook where, you know, here's the name. You know, they'll check every other fact they can check. You know, I don't know how any fact checkers deal with is the problem of reporters in distant locales who were, you know, recounting events and scenes, which is what this diarist was. Let me give you an example. There was actually a famous scandal in the early 1980s at the New Yorker. The New Yorker's fact checking process is famous. I mean, it's you know, there are all these great stories about how they fly their fact checkers across the world to, you know, retrace the steps of this and that, or, you know, it's supposedly just, you know, above and beyond everything else. But they had a writer on staff who basically had falsified details in story after story after story after story. He had made up characters, he had made up anecdotes, he had changed, you know, little details for no apparent reason, and all of these had slipped by. And the reason is because you can't fact check that kind of thing. So, you know, that's, you know, in the context of fact checking, you want to be careful by making statements because it can be easily be interpreted like I'm making a statement about the New Republic to say, like, well, we can't prove this happened, we can't be sure. But this is basically true of journalism in general, right? There's some things when you have a writer who says, well, this happened to me, you know, over here, you can have other people corroborate it. You can have, you can say, well, you could find experts to tell you if it could have happened, but you can't prove one way or another that it happened.
Right. Well, and I'm actually not sure. I should probably haul in one of our fact checkers, but I'm not sure what would happen if, say, Robert Kaplan turned in a story that described how he had watched a bunch of guys make fun of a disfigured woman in a Baghdad mess hall. Like, I'm not sure if they would ask him for a corroborative source or not, or if they're sort of, as you say, there's a sense of, well, the reporter's in a foreign locale. I mean, the expression is on author. You know, certain facts in a piece are on author, and if they're wrong, then the author has to be responsible for them.
Yeah.
And I think that this is actually something that, I mean, that gets at something that I think was missed in a lot of the right-wing blogosphere reaction, and I think that this is something that holds true across the blogosphere, right and left. I think that there's a misunderstanding. There's sort of an odd, almost bipolar phenomenon among bloggers who critique sort of mainstream media institutions, where on the one hand, it's sort of assumed that the mainstream media is, you know, out of touch, incompetent, they're going to get facts wrong all the time, and so forth, and only the bloggers can ride in to save the day. And on the other hand, it's assumed that, you know, the mainstream media there, this powerful institution with an army of fact-checkers, how can they ever get anything wrong? And if they get anything wrong, you know, Frank Ford should resign and so on.
Right.
I mean, so, yeah. So I'm not totally sure what my point is here, except that I think that there is sort of, in some of these scandals, there's a misapprehension about, one, how hard it is to fact-check pieces, and two, whether it's a good idea to... I think it's Michael Kinsley who had the, you would know this better than I maybe, but who had the line about Slate. He said, you know, we have you know, fact checkers. They're called writers and editors.
Right.
And, you know, that essentially, you know, if you run something that's wrong, you publish a retraction and you never have the guy write for you again. But overall, you sort of place trust in your authors and their editor's discretion. And for a publication that comes out, I mean, The Atlantic has a tremendous luxury. Where it's also a disadvantage in other ways, but, you know, we have a month or 6 months to prepare an article, and so we have the time to go through and ensure that every fact is correct.
Yeah.
But certainly a place like Slate, also a place like TNR. Anyway, I guess I'm sort of marshaling the preemptive defense. But all that said, I mean, what in hindsight, what do you think? I'm obviously not asking you to criticize the overall editorial judgment of TNR, but, like, do you think there's anything that sort of TNR should have done differently in this case with these kind of pieces, like been more sensitive to the fact that, you know, you are having somebody write as sort of the voice of the troops and that's going to attract controversy? What do you think?
I don't know. I mean, I don't think it was our intent. Look, you're right. He was the only soldier we've had writing for us during this war, you know, because he came to our attention through his wife, who's on our staff.
Right.
You know, and so I don't think there was some deliberate plan to go out and get a soldier to write for us. It was, hey, you know, this guy or my husband or however it worked is in Iraq. He, you know, he's a good writer. You know, he wants to write. Let's give it a shot. So, yeah, I mean, I think that was a pretty good decision. I think, you know, I don't know. I, you know, aside from that important detail, it was right. You know, his pieces have held up. Like you said, you know, the way they're written carries a little bit of a whiff of overwriting. And, you know,
let's just take the example of the one fact that we know he got wrong, right? The mess hall was in Kuwait. It was before he got to Iraq, rather than it was what he said, which was right. I forget exactly what he said. It was in Iraq. I mean, you know, okay, that's not a huge error. Right. However, part of the theme of the piece was look at the desensitizing effects of warfare. Yeah. And in his quest to prove the desensitizing effects of warfare, he basically argued, you know, he had an anecdote that made it seem like he'd been in theater for a while, he'd mm-hmm. been, you know, coming back, and so that, you know, it had made him this terrible guy who would make jokes about, you know, the IED pinup girls of the month or whatever. And in fact, he was making these jokes before he got, you know, before he got into Iraq. I mean, it reflects worse on him in a way, but it doesn't, you know, it undercuts the point he's making, and it just seemed like, well, anyway, so.
Yeah, well, look, let me just, since you're making the indictment, let me prepare the defense. I concede it's possible that he knew this took place in Kuwait all along and decided to lie about it. It's also possible that he forgot and thought he was in one mess hall when he was in another mess hall. And I would also say that thematically, it's quite possible. Like, first of all, like, we found out about this shortly before he was made incommunicado, so we couldn't press him on it in the way we wanted to, which is, you know, reflected in our statement. But, you know, maybe in his mind, you know, this was a process that began, you know, when he became a soldier and, you know, had to learn, you know, went through basic training, you know, had to learn to shoot people and, you know, was put in this sort of, you know, you know, the whole kind of bonding ritual that happens when you join the army.
You can certainly imagine that he had been, you know, desensitized to suffering before he got to Iraq.
Right. I mean,
all I'm saying is it's the kind of embellishment. I mean, I wrote a nonfiction book that was memoirish about college, and, you know, and there were moments when I, you know, collapsed time frames a little bit and change details slightly, consciously or unconsciously, and, you know, there's always the urge to, you know, to
left-wing bloggers take note of that. Left-wing bloggers, if you're watching this, start going through Ross's book. I think we may have a major scandal on our hands.
This is the thing. Like, and this is, you know, the sort of eternal debate about nonfiction. Like, in the book, I have the note at the beginning that says some characters. I forget exactly what it says, but it says, you know, some characters are composites, and names have been changed. And in the process of compositing characters, then, you know, you composite time frames too. And the standard, you know, the standard that I set up for myself, and every nonfiction writer sets up probably a slightly different standard, is, you know, include no events that are untrue, that did not happen. And, you know, and in that sense, maybe you could argue that Beauchamp passes the test because this, you know, this event actually did happen. The question is whether, you know, again, whether it's something where the crucial change was moving it into theater in order to... Yeah. Anyway,
I think he could have written the piece even if he acknowledged up front that it was Kuwait. I mean, assuming he didn't forget, even if he knew corrected that error, I think the piece could have written it. It would have read a little differently, but I think he could have basically had the same piece and it wouldn't have been wildly different. You're right. I mean, I think you're right. I think any time you have people creating narratives out of events in their life, you know, as an outsider reading it, some of them feel a little compressed, and sometimes when it's something you know a little bit, you know, you know. I mean, it's like, you know, I don't get written about often, but, you know, occasionally when the New Republic gets written about, I see that the writer is taking events and they're sort of putting them together in a way to make a story. But, like, when people write about themselves in a nonfiction way, you know, they say, after X event, it was never the same. You know, this was a key moment. But, in fact, some of the things that happened after, things like that, some of them actually happened before also. I think that's pretty common, so...
It is pretty common. I would note, though, that TNR just, well, not just, but 4 months ago or something, ran a piece that I found very interesting by Alex Beam about David Sedaris,
right.
who does exactly this on a grand scale. I think Beam got a lot of flack, at least, you know, again, on the blogs I read, for essentially being too much of a literalist and, like, look, there are different rules for humorous writing of the kind Sedaris does than for, you know, more serious writing and so on. But it's just, there is sort of again, obviously TNR doesn't have some editorial line on the nature of nonfiction, but it's interesting to contrast the sort of Beam piece with this controversy.
Yeah, though I will point out that Alex Beam ended up defending David Sedaris and basically saying, you know, he makes up a lot of stuff, but, it's okay. He wasn't writing as I think that was widely misinterpreted. His point, he tried to have a subtle take and basically say, like, and not come across as a journalism school. I don't think people got that point at all.
No, I don't think they did either, and I think the problem was if you do a piece that's, you know, three quarters listing, and it was very interesting to read the list, but listing all the ways in which Sedaris embellishes, changes, you know, and so forth, and then at the end your conclusion is this is probably okay, people are still going to take the point that, like, no, you're trying to expose what David Sedaris does. But anyway, I don't want to exhaust our viewers' patience with the
Let's move on.
The ins and outs of nonfiction journalism.
What about spell checking? How do you spell check? What about how do you catch grammatical mistakes? I'm just kidding.
Oh, you're right.
I didn't want to.
You had me frozen in panic there for a moment. No, well, it's interesting with blogging that there's such. I got an email the other day about a typo in one of my blog posts, and the writer said, you know, if this had appeared in Matt Iglesias's, I wouldn't have sent him an email. But you so rarely have typos, I thought I should point it out. And it's true that I have, like, an obsessive type. Like, I will post a blog post and reread it for typos and so on. And that's sort of antithetical to the spirit of the blogosphere. But, which is, you know, throw it out and, you know, figure people are smart enough to know that if you misspell the word, you didn't mean to. But
plus, you've proven that you're willing to publish lies on a wide scale, so I don't see why you should be any different with your blog posts.
That's, yes, well said.
All right, so
let's go, since we were just talking about sort of soldiers in Iraq.
Yes.
Why don't we shift gears and talk about pundits in Iraq, or not pundits, but serious security analysts? Because I don't think I've ever seen an op-ed cause quite as much of a sort of political controversy as the Michael O'Hanlon, Kenneth Pollack op-ed about how we might just win in Iraq that came out, I guess it came out a week ago now?
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Yeah, so basically they both went to Iraq. They traveled around, saw various parts of the country, usually under military escort, talked to a bunch of people, came back, and co-wrote a piece arguing that, you know, the surge was going, you know, better than they had thought, and the title of the piece was "A War We Might Just Win," and both of them, I think, have suggested that that was a slightly misleading title, and obviously in the piece they said, you know, we still need a political solution and so on, but the tone was
"just might" is a pretty qualified statement, but yeah.
Right, but the tone of the op-ed was surprisingly upbeat, and this became something that, you know, Republican politicians were citing in speeches that, you know, everybody on the conservative side was sort of treating as a watershed moment in the debate within Washington about the war.
Yeah.
And meanwhile, both Pollack and O'Hanlon took very heavy fire from just about everybody to the left of, you know,
me,
you, exactly, or even further. So do you have any thoughts on this? What does this signify?
Well, I have a lot of thoughts. Number one, I think they made a big mistake in their media strategy. And I think what they did was they just, you know, went on whatever TV shows and talked to whatever reporters wanted to talk to them, which is the natural reaction. But the effect of it was, to make them kind of right-wing mascots for, you know, see who we're going to win. And, you know, I think the message they had was a good message for liberals. It basically would, you know, say, hey, we have to take seriously the possibility that things are changing. You know, let's not just have foregone conclusions. Let's sort of keep an open mind to new evidence. Some of this is kind of good. It doesn't mean we're going to win. You know, like, as a message to liberals, I think it was, you know, a productive one. As a message to conservatives, I think it was a disastrous one, because it allowed them just to confirm everything that they wanted to believe and just shut out all the contrary evidence and say, see, even these left-wing analysts, these Bush haters admit that the war is going right, which is just, you know, whatever. These are very moderate guys who supported the war in the first place. And the whole way it was presented to conservatives, I think, was a disaster. And I think they made a huge mistake in allowing themselves to be used that way. But you know, I don't think that substantively what they wrote was on its face crazy. I mean, they conceded that politically things are going badly, still badly. There's no progress at all. But that there is some military progress, and you know, and I think the point, and you know, some of the left critique of them was, well, see, you know, you admitted that politically it's going nowhere. So all this is useless and meaningless, and who cares? But it does have meaning, because the military situation does have some impact on the political situation. And I think you could, you know, foresee a circumstance where, you know, certain kind of military progress, you know, pushes the political situation in the right way.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's interesting from my point of view, and I think based on your blogging, you feel the same way. I have no defined opinion about what we should do in Iraq these days.
Right.
So I sort of, you know, twist back and forth depending on what I've just read, and I've sort of tended towards, you know, a fear of the moderate middle and gravitation towards either the extreme of, you know, continuing the surge through 2008 or whatever Petraeus wants to do, or the sort of immediate withdrawal out of fear that the sort of intermediate option will get us all the bad consequences of staying and you know, none of the benefits of
right.
pulling out. So that's sort of the frame through which I was following this debate. And it's interesting to me, watching sort of Republican proponents of staying, Republican proponents of the surge and so forth, and, you know, figures like Bill Kristol, for instance, who I know and am friendly with, mm-hmm. who, you know, have taken obviously an awful lot of fire for doing exactly what you just said, doing things like seizing on the Pollack O'Hanlon piece and sort of, you know, trumpeting to the rooftops as, you know, evidence that we're succeeding and the surge needs to continue. And I thought I might attempt a, you know, qualified defense of that sort of strategy from conservative pundits, in the knowledge that, you know, I think the war was a mistake, and I'm certainly more skeptical about the surge than many of my compatriots on the right of center. But I think that, you know, one of the things that people don't quite follow when they watch, for instance, that Bill Kristol make these kinds of arguments is, well, for one thing, there's an assumption of bad faith, and that assumption is based on the fact that often in his pieces, Kristol seems to be cherry-picking evidence and so forth to support his contentions that the surge is working.
You have to have an assumption of bad faith with Bill Kristol. I mean, that's just how he operates.
Right.
Even
well,
when he's right,
enough.
He's arguing in bad faith. I mean, everything he writes for a reason. He writes because he wants to create, you know, the political consequences that he thinks are good. He doesn't just
right. This is where my defense comes in. I don't think that, you know, writing that in, well, I'm not sure that's a good use of the term bad faith. I mean, I think that when, you know, Bill Kristol writes a piece that maybe selectively uses evidence to suggest that, to argue that the surge is succeeding. I mean, the reality on the ground in Iraq is so fluid, and it's so difficult to say whether the surge is succeeding or, you know, or whether it isn't, that for, you know, if you believe, as people who share Kristol's point of view on the war do believe, that the consequences of a U.S., you know, pullout from Iraq would be utterly disastrous, that this would be, you know, a colossal defeat in, you know, what is a global struggle and so forth, then from that point of view, for them, you know, the only thing they can do, in a sense, from a moral perspective, you might argue, and I suspect you'll argue against me on this, is to put the best face on the surge possible, given and, you know, accepting that it's a fluid situation and so forth, because the alternatives to the surge are so awful. And, you know, and I think that lots of people on the sort of stay and fight right, you know, there is sort of a contingent of, you know, Cheneyite, like, I don't want to say Cheney nutcases, but, you know, people who are completely detached from reality. But there are, you know, there's also a contingent of people who look at the situation in Iraq and see it as, you know, a potential genocide, you know, or at least a situation with the potential for enormous casualties if the U.S. pulls out. And, I mean, it's true that, like, you are then essentially practicing journalism as politics rather than journalism as journalism, and maybe that is ipso facto bad faith. But I think that I guess all I'm saying is that I can see where, given a certain set of premises, you end up with the kind of pieces that Crystal has been writing of late.
Yeah. Well, let me give you a better example of the kind of thing I'm talking about. I think Crystal has certain issues that he cares a lot about, mostly foreign policy. And he's sort of willing to create coalitions and go along with whatever political forces, especially within the Republican Party, that he thinks will, you know, lead to those results that he wants. So, you know, he thought the Republican Party was going too isolationist in the late 1990s, so he created this national greatness conservatism, which was really an empty shell, but a way of creating a rubric for, you know, an interventionist foreign policy. Then he latched on to the McCain campaign, and he seemed to get all excited about McCain's reformism and progressivism and the Teddy Roosevelt spirit and taking on, you know, big business and the lobbyists and the entrenched interests. But it was really just that McCain, you know, I think had these foreign policy goals that he shared, and so he was happy to go along with the rest of the program. Now he sees Bush as the best vehicle for his foreign policy goals, and so he writes things like that piece in the Washington Post saying how Bush is going to go down in history as a great president, and he defends everything Bush has done, including the Medicare
bill. I don't
think
he didn't say he was going down in history as a great president.
As a successful president.
I think he was saying go down in history as a successful president.
Successful, right. But he defended everything Bush did, including, you know, like the Medicare bill, which, you know, he doesn't know or care about the Medicare bill, but, you know, praising the Medicare bill and saying it's a big success, which no policy analyst on left or right thinks that was a good bill, or center, or anywhere.
No, although it did, no doubt you follow this much more closely than I have, but my impression is that the Medicare bill has, as, you know, regardless of what you think of the expansion of government side of it, has turned out a lot better than the policy analysts to left and right expected it to come in under budget, and it hasn't, you know, there hasn't been the sort of there were a lot of predictions, particularly on the left, that seniors would be very unhappy with it, and instead seniors seem pretty happy with it. I mean, it seems like a more successful entitlement program than people thought when it was passed.
I'm not saying there is. I mean, I think there's a germ of a point there, and there's an argument he could latch onto, but I would bet everything, every dollar I have, that Bill Crystal doesn't care about that, right? I mean, If George W. Bush had pulled out of Iraq, he wouldn't be praising the Medicare bill. He was saying everything he's done is a disaster. Look at the Medicare bill. Look at his withdrawal from Iraq. I mean, it's just instrumental for him.
No, okay. Well, see, I disagree with you there. I mean, I think I agree with you that Crystal cares far more about foreign policy than he does about other issues. But I also think that, you know, Crystal is, in a sense, a genuine neoconservative in the sense that, and a neoconservative, you know, in the late 1990s sense, sort of post-Cold War, where they, became more interventionist and more pro-democracy promotion. But he also has, you know, this sort of the neoconservative side of being a point of view that I share, the view that, you know, conservatism should be for reforms of the welfare state rather than for the abolition of the welfare state, a skepticism about the small government right. I mean, there is a reason that, you know, that the Weekly Standard published the piece that Raihan and I wrote about the Party of Sam's Club. There's a reason that they have published sort of subsequent pieces arguing for a more sort of traditionally neoconservative domestic policy as against the small government right. And in a sense, everything that he's done, I mean, you were talking about his fascination with McCain, but I think his fascination with McCain fits very well into that particular constellation of issues, that McCain was, you know, Bush was sort of the orthodox small government conservative in the race, and McCain was the more, you know, reform-minded conservative, and therefore, yeah, I guess, so all I'm saying is I think you should underestimate the extent to which Bill Crystal actually believes certain things on domestic policy, too.
I think his beliefs are extraordinarily weak, and I think he's basically willing to subordinate them. And if you look at the Weekly Standard, you know, they publish Steve Moore. I mean, he's at the Wall Street Journal now, but like these other supply-siders
The Weekly Standard has a strong, like, sort of supply-side streak. But you notice, for instance, that when Bush was, you know, pushing privatization of Social Security, they didn't really write anything about it, and barely, they wrote a couple tepid pieces, they ran a couple tepid pieces praising it, but it clearly wasn't something that they, you know, that sort of fit in with the overall Weekly Standard worldview.
No, that's right. They were willing to go with the program because they were on board, they were on the team, yeah.
Well, look. No. Clearly, Crystal is a figure who does, you know, for whom, as you say, coalitions are important. Journalism, as you know, as an extension of politics, is more important than it is for, say, people at TNR. And yeah. You'll get no argument from me on that. But I think that there is a consistent. Crystal is consistently pro-life, consistently pro-intervention, and consistently pro-sort of. Reforming the welfare state rather than abolishing it. And I think that, you know, streak runs through the last decade worth of the Weekly Standard.
Well, my next column is on Crystal and might be on the web this week. It might even be up before people see this blogging head segment, depending on how it goes. So I'll leave my piece at that, and the rest you can read in the New Republic.
I'll look forward to it, but let me just push ahead with my, you know, perhaps increasingly outlandish argument and just say, at the beginning of this conversation about the O'Hanlon Pollock piece, you were saying, you know, well, look, the reaction, the piece was, you know, well targeted for the center or for the center left, the people right. who aren't sure what to think about the surge, but the conservative reaction was, you know, absolutely terrible. Well, but imagine for a minute, a world in which there were no conservative rump. Like, let's say there's a conservative rump of maybe 25 to 30% of the country that still really believes strongly in the Iraq war. Mm-hmm. And there's a conservative rump that's probably like 60% of the conservative punditocracy, maybe more like 70 or 80, that also still believes strongly. Now, yeah. Clearly, you, as someone who's in the moderate middle, or, you know, this sort of where I am too, unsure what we want to do about Iraq, right. thinks that rump is wrong and often crazy. But would the Iraq debate be better if that rump disappeared? No. I mean, then the Iraq debate would swing between, you know, Baker Hamilton on the one hand and immediate withdrawal on the other. I mean, in a sense, if you as a center-left pundit think the surge might have a chance of succeeding, you should actually want the right-wing crazies to get excited about an O'Hanlon Pollock op-ed, right? What do you think?
I don't even think most of them read the op-ed. They just, you know, to them, they either saw Pollock and O'Hanlon on Fox News or they just heard what the Republican summary, which was, you know, left-wing Bush haters admit Bush is winning, which is essentially the version that Republicans transmitted. So, you know, I think the world would have been a better place if no one right of center ever read or knew of the Pollock or O'Hanlon op-ed and everyone left of center digested it very thoroughly.
Okay, fair enough. Well, do you want to switch and talk about another Washington Post op-ed?
Sure.
Okay, do you want to summarize? Because I think you've read this one more carefully than I have. It's the Kagan Dalder piece.
Yeah, I blogged about this morning, which could be a couple days by the time people see this, but I blogged about this at the New Republic, TNR.com. So I think there was an interesting op-ed by Robert Kagan, who's a neoconservative foreign policy intellectual, and I consider him, you know, it's faint praise to be sure, the smartest, most honest of the neoconservatives. My colleague Lawrence Kaplan might qualify as well, although he's less. Lawrence isn't quite as much of a neocon anymore. He's still, anyway, I'm rambling. Kagan, you know, smart guy, much more honest, much more fair-minded, less partisan than Crystal, but a real neocon. And Ivo Dalder, who's at Brookings and is a real liberal. He's not like Pollock and O'Hanlon. He's he was a Howard Dean supporter. He opposed the Iraq War. So they've got a joint op-ed that I think, you know, has a really interesting take, mostly, you know, by who's saying and what they're agreeing on. What they basically agree on, they agree on two points. There's a concession from the left and a concession from the right, and then a way to go forward. The concession from the left is that you can't rely on the United Nations Security Council to provide all the legitimacy for American interventions. Foreign intervention is something America does regularly under Democrats and Republicans, and you know a lot of the regimes in the Security Council are fairly noxious ones that don't have any decent considerations at heart, and we shouldn't allow them to exercise a veto. And that's quite a concession from the left, from Dalder. And Kagan said, but look, even though you can't just judge an intervention on its own strength, which was the conservative argument for war, you can't just say, well, you know, this is the right thing to do, so we're doing it regardless of who likes it. You need some kind of foreign legitimacy, if nothing else, for pragmatic reasons. So what they came to was this idea of a concert of democracies that would be sort of parallel UN Security Council, but only include democracies, and that would be sort of the institution we rely on more. And, you know, I think it seems like, it's not their idea, it's not a new idea, but I think it's an interesting one. And I think, again, the way they came to it is interesting.
Yes. And I agree with both of their concessions. Mm-hmm. It's the third part that I think is not such a good idea. I mean, I think it's absolutely true that, you know, the UN and particularly the Security Council are never going to be sort of an adequate force for providing legitimacy to military operations overseas, simply because, you know, of the kind of veto power that the nations involved wield, and because overall, you know, as they say, the UN is, you know, it's like here comes everybody, and as conservatives were pointing out before the Iraq War, you're getting, you know, Libya on the Human Rights Commission and so on. I mean, like, as a force of moral legitimacy, the UN is weak. There's no question. And there's also no question that international legitimacy is important to interventions. And the more, you know, the more international legitimacy you get, the more successful an intervention is likely to be. League of Democracies, though. The logistical hurdles to it, first of all, seem to me to be pretty high. I mean, you start out, okay, so the U.S. is a member, Canada is a member, the Western European countries are members. And then you start running into, like, you know, the question of, like, okay, so is Venezuela a member? Like, what about these sort of Latin American populist, quasi-democratic states? What about your sub-Saharan African countries that, you know, will have an election for, and then, you know, the person will, and so on. And so, you know, Japan gets to be a member. Does Singapore get to be a member? You know, what's your standard? Like, if China starts having more elections at the local level, like, at what point do you reach the standard of becoming a member? So those are the logistical hurdles. From a foreign policy standpoint, I mean, the fact is that Russia is a lot weaker than it used to be, but Russia is still, you know, a major power in the world. Mm-hmm. And China is essentially probably the second most powerful country in the world. I'd say that that's fair to say now, and their power is rising and their influence is rising. Mm-hmm. So from the point of view of the U.S., like, you know, we need these countries' cooperation in a lot of things we do, at least as much, if not more, than we need the Western European powers. I think that's like the advantages of having France on board for something that we want to do are vastly outweighed by the advantages of either having China on board or having China say, you know, okay, go ahead and do that. Mm-hmm. I just think you have to look at how this would look from the vantage point of Beijing and Moscow, regimes that are not actually our enemies. They're just sort of generally our rivals, occasionally our partners. For us to say, okay, we're going to form this new quasi-UN that's going to be more legitimate than the UN and that you can't join, although maybe Russia could join, or maybe it couldn't.
Right, I'd say
we're gonna go around the world having interventions wherever we want that are rubber stamped by this organization. I mean, I don't think it would be
rubber stamped. I mean, no. I mean, you know, there's enough discord within democracies that I think it would be a significant restraint.
No, that's true. That's true. And if you have the Western European powers in there, you'd end up with many of the same kind of, or if you ended up with Latin American countries having a veto and so on. But it seems like, yeah, I mean, you can. The more you water it down, the more it just looks like the UN all over again. The more you strengthen it, the more it just looks like sort of U.S. hegemony on steroids. With us, you know.
But if you strengthen it, you wouldn't have had the Iraq War, at least not the way we had it. You would have had Kosovo. You could open the door for something in Darfur, I think.
But we had Kosovo anyway. Right. And Kosovo ran into, you know, to the extent that Kosovo was a bad idea, it was because it ran into the exact same problems that a League of Democracies intervention would run into, which is to say resistance from Russia. If you included Russia in the League of Democracies, then they'd be vetoing interventions in Kosovo and the Russian near abroad.
Well, they say They say no, and I agree. So, you know.
And I think you could, you know, and for instance, like, and also, like, things like Darfur, for instance. Like, right. You know, the reason, one reason we can't do an intervention in Darfur, if that's a good idea, is because of the nature of the UN and the problems of international legitimacy and all the rest. The real reason we can't do an intervention in Darfur is because of Iraq. I mean, there are all kinds of things the U.S. could manage to do if we hadn't invaded Iraq.
Yep.
And I think that that's, you know, that's a much bigger problem than the fact that, like, you know, China would veto a Security Council resolution involving Darfur overall. Mm-hmm. So anyway, so I've said enough on that score. What do you think?
Well, like I said, you know, they say, you know, I think they say pretty clearly, or at least by clear implication, that Russia would not be part of it. So, you know, Kosovo would not be a problem there. You're right about Iraq.
They're right. Yes, they say major. As the war in Kosovo showed, democracies can agree and act effectively even when major non-democracies, right, such as Russia and China, do not. Yeah,
I think you can. And, you know, I don't think that, you know, you're right. Russia sort of freaked out about Kosovo, but it was okay in the end. And I don't think either of them
freaked
out.
It was sort of a near-run thing there. And if we'd ended up, you know, doing what Wes Clark had wanted and putting boots on the ground, we weren't actually going to get in World War whatever it is, 18 or something with Russia, but I mean, I'm sort of a skeptic about the Kosovo intervention overall. So,
I'm not at all. No, I think that was I think it was a success. I agree that there are logistical and conceptual difficulties, but I think you could get it so it's not too hot, not too cold, not too restrictive, not too permissive. You end up doing the kinds of interventions that I want us to do, and still getting the kind of legitimacy that I want us to get, even at some cost of not having freedom of action.
Maybe, but why? I mean, doesn't NATO give you that already? I mean, it just seems like once you're opening, you know, if you say, okay, NATO doesn't give us quite the legitimacy we need to intervene in certain African countries, but then once you're including lots of African countries in this League of Democracy, you're going to have the same UN kind of problems where, you know...
No, I don't know if you would. You've got NATO, you've got India, Japan, at least it gives it a certain non-European, non-white cast. And, you know, South America...
But do you really think... I mean, the reason that, you know, African countries don't want interventions in African countries isn't just because, you know, they don't like the Yankee imperialists. I think they dislike the Yankee Japanese Indian imperialists almost as much. I don't know.
I don't know how much opposition is there to what have there been to, you know, intervention in Rwanda. How much would there be to intervention in Darfur?
We didn't intervene in Rwanda because of domestic policy considerations, because Bill Clinton got cold feet and was afraid of, you know, and because Richard Clark was saying, you know, we don't want to intervene, we'll have too many casualties. You know, Russia and China didn't stop us from intervening in Rwanda. Clinton was a coward, and Clinton has said as much. He said, "Yes, I was a coward. That's why we didn't intervene."
That's true, but that's not the point. The point isn't that this would create a panacea. And she's saying that this is a framework that would kind of, you could see it being done as a way that, you know, it's like it lets in some of the good stuff and keeps out some of the bad stuff, and as a framework that going forward could work. That, you know,
yeah,
that there are things you could do under the rubric, you know, successfully, and it would, you know, so.
Yeah, no, I just think that would be, if you created it to a point where it would have real benefits, those would probably be outweighed by the fact that it would, have extremely negative consequences for our relationship with Russia and China.
Yeah.
And if you take the, you know, whatever we want to call it, war on terror, whatever, to be something that's very important to U.S. security interests, an awful lot of that is going on and continuing to go on in the belt of countries between Russia and, you know, at Russia's southern border and China's western border. And I think that,
right,
from our point of view, I don't know. How long have we been going now? We've been going for 49 minutes.
Too long.
Too long?
Yeah.
Okay. So you want to call a halt without getting to the exciting topic of
Yeah, we can't even... Don't stop. We can't reveal the secret.
Okay, we won't reveal the secrets. Our audience will never know what we would have discussed if we hadn't wasted so much time about talking about, you know, U.S. foreign policy and
CNR's the really juicy stuff. I know. We have to get to this before because I almost can't contain myself. It's so juicy. It's so titillating that we're going to discuss. But we'll hold off. It'll be like the in Pulp Fiction, you know, the box where there's something in it, but you don't know what.
We know it. I mean, that was Marcellus Wallace's soul, right? Don't we know that? Didn't
you tell me?
But yes, no, I agree.
Yeah.
Okay. Well, it was a great pleasure talking to you then, John.
You too, Russ. All right. As always. Until next time.
Take care.
Okay. Bye.
Bye.